Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our awesome guest is Massimo Zeffirino, founder of Z-Factor, a 23-year-old brand strategy and design agency, and we're going to talk about building a brand agency, which they definitely succeeded at. This show is brought to you by UserList, the best tool for sending onboarding emails and segmenting your SaaS users. To follow the best practices, download our free printable email planning worksheets at userlist.com/worksheets. Hey, Massimo.
Hey, Jane. How are you?
We are excited to have you here today. We are absolutely delighted to learn how you did it for so long and you build your brand. And now we can't wait to learn how. But before that, tell us what you do and what you did before building Z-Factor, which was probably going to kindergarten or something. I don't know.
Well, thank you. I think that's good. I think that's a compliment. I guess I might maybe hide how old I actually am. But yeah, you're right. You know, I'm one of the fortunate few because it was just the only thing I ever wanted to do in life. So I am blessed in that sense. You know, we've been running our agency now for 23 years. You know, through this, we've grown in so many ways. We've learned about the agency and the industry and how the industry has changed. It's been kind of crazy, actually. And then through this, you know, we've also, part of the branding exercise is creating, obviously, our YouTube channel to kind of promote our niche, which we can definitely talk about. And then recently, within the past 8 months, we started up a podcast, not towards clients, though, but more towards the graphic designers and designers in general. So it's been a really fun roller coaster. This is one of those experiences where if you do what you love, then you're not going to work a day in your life. And I truly don't feel like I've ever had to work. It's been amazing. So I'm pretty lucky in that sense.
Tell us how large your team is and what you specialize in. What's your focus? Because you've got to stay focused, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we've got a good, nimble team of 12 employees. It's 12 of us. We have designers on staff. We've got front-end programmer, back-end programmers on staff. We've got a full-time copywriter. We've got account managers. We have a really good, well-balanced team all in-house. And then, of course, through this, we've got relationships with other agencies if we need to bring in for other special services, like if we need somebody to do a pay-per-click campaign or some Salesforce, you know, integration, funneling work, that stuff I respect. There's probably better people specialized in that than we would be. So we are a very niche brand strategy company. You know, we specialize in B2B technology companies. And our mantra, of course, is we help technology companies be more human and look more global. So although we offer a breadth of services, because again, we're, you know, a creative agency, we're brand and strategy agency, and we're also digital development, we do it in a very niche space. We understand technology. We understand how technology works. So, of course, the benefit to the customer is that it doesn't take us long to ramp up and understand their technology. You know, we can usually pick it up within the first phone call and then start kind of bringing down, you know, what their problems are from there. You know, of course, the more customers you meet, the more similarities you see. And there's one thing I can tell you for sure is virtually every technology company, regardless if they're a startup or if they're an enterprise company, multi-billion dollar company, they all suffer from the same thing. So it's kind of a neat correlation. They, you know, everything.
What is it? Break it.
They're too damn smart for their own good. Okay. And that's the problem. I mean, tech companies are started by, you know, technology enthusiasts, people who actually love tech. They're interested in tech. And not that that's a bad thing. That's a great thing. But the reality is because they love tech, they associate with tech and they don't know how to actually make tech more human, right? And, you know, that's the one thing that a company like Apple did well because, you know, Steve Jobs wasn't exactly the most, he thought he was a lot more technical than he was, but what he actually was, he was really connected to people and how to actually, you know, convert technology to, you know, humans and make it easier because let's face it. I mean, people, they're scared as hell for technology. They really don't want to know. They just want to know how it can improve their lives. And so that's where, you know, we come in. We have a strong understanding of technology from IoT to telecommunications, a lot of SaaS products, and we're able to translate what that technology not necessarily is, but what it does for people. And I think that's where often the founders of technology companies or the leaders of technology companies, you know, often suffer because they suffer from, what is it? The curse of knowledge, right? They know too much. They're too smart for their own good. And it's hard to step away and explain things in a way that other people would understand. So they often just assume people understand, you know, what they're talking about. But often what they're talking about is a lot more technical than people need to know. So it's kind of fun. It is definitely fun when we start dissecting these companies, but it's amazing the similarities between companies, you know, as large as Google all the way down to just like your local startup at an incubator. So
I have a few practical questions, which I'm sure you can answer given your ages of experience, because, you know, sometimes it's good for things to look nice, etc. But when you know how things are actually used down the road and you've seen many, many of them, then you start looking at everything from the angle of practicality. Like, I suffer from that a ton, because I think there is like a very, very limited range of things that can be used without being broken or, you know, misaligned or anything like that, you know, when it comes to brand logos, everything.
When you're too close to the source, you can't see outside of it, right? I mean, again, you're in it too much. I mean, there's so many UX theories on this, of course, but when you're too close to what you're working on, I mean, it's common just to start, you know, to overshadow your issues and start focusing in on everybody else's. It's just, if we can, this is where it's like the outside source works well.
So I have two questions. They don't relate to our main topic. One, how do you think a good software logo should look like? And this is a really vague question, but for example, I know that it shouldn't be too thin. It shouldn't be too, you know, too bright. There is a pretty specific range of practical values that the logo can be like. And do you often deviate from that, saying that the logo is like a simple square and no letters at all or something like that? Or do you prefer practical solutions for your clients?
Interesting. Okay, so that's stuff that we can talk about all day long, unfortunately.
Yeah,
I mean,
sorry.
Logos like my passion, of course, logo and brand development. I mean, so obviously there's two sides. One thing that we actually do on our podcast is we actually will critique logos. We will absolutely critique logos. And of course, I'll have my own personal feelings about logos. I'm someone mid-century. I like things that are, you know, easy to understand, that they're easy to follow, and that they're classic. That's just me personally, right? However, we do internally here critique artwork, especially logos and brands, under five areas, right? So if you want to talk about, you know, the strengths of a good logo, right? We follow simplicity. You know, are they minimal? Are they iconic? Are they relevant? And are they timeless? So this is what we always recommend to any of the brands that we're building and working on, or rebranding, of course. So simplicity, of course, it's common for people to try to add so many elements into a logo and tell this entire story, right? They're expecting that, you know, their one logo people are going to look at and understand, you know, the entire founder's story from when they were a child until when they started this company. But the reality is, I mean, it just has to get one thing across. So the logo needs to be simple in that sense. Just tell one simple message story. Okay. Minimal. Okay. Right now, what you see, and it's just nature with companies like Fiverr and 99 Designs and this and that, right? They're all just going crazy with it. They're adding drop shadows. They're adding, you know, gradients. They're adding flourishes, this and that. And all of a sudden, it's not minimal anymore, right? Reproduction suffers. So what we're saying is scale it back. Keep your logo minimal, right? Does it really need that gradient, you know, or can it work flat? We always recommend, you know, the logo should always work black and white, even though now we're in a digital age, digital first, it will never show up in just black and white. But the thing is, it has to stand on its own before you start adding color, before you start adding shadows and this and that. Otherwise, it requires all these other elements to tell a good story. Number three is the iconic part, right? A logo needs to stand on its own and recognizable. So if you take that name away, that symbol that represents, you know, your brand, that logo mark needs to be iconic enough that people are going to remember. It can't be generic. It can't just be two lines that look like this or two arrows that look like that or look like everybody else's logo on Fiverr. It needs to be iconic enough that people will remember that logo, right? And recognize it. Relevant is one of the most important parts because, again, your logo needs to be relevant to your market. So if you're running a vegan food chain, your logo probably shouldn't be a chicken, right? Or have anything to do with that in that sense. It needs to be relevant to that market. So this is where, you know, often founders will try to create something that's more personal to them, but it might not be relevant to their market. And of course, last but not least, timeless, right? Logos need to evolve over time. If you start off with something that's trendy, you're going to have to keep changing it every time there's a new trend. And then what happens is that really dilutes your brand. Tech companies suffer from this because tech companies often, when they start, they don't have a clear direction. And so their brand often pivots based on opportunities. You know, there's one new opportunity, they pivot to that. Well, now we're going to focus on healthcare. Then all of a sudden they get something with distribution. Wow, well, we're going to now go to distribution. We have a new, and their whole brand just keeps pivoting and pivoting based on opportunities. And what happens is their brand becomes fragmented. It becomes very weak. It becomes diluted. So what we recommend is create something that's timeless, that has a clear, you know, end goal in sight, and keep it moving forward regardless of the opportunities. So, you know, when people try to create something that's too trendy, you know, it's just going to make, you know, your pitch deck look different from you, your salesperson, your website will look different, your LinkedIn profile will look different. And that really does have an effect on, you know, we know it has effect, of course, on attaining talent, retaining talent, but then it also has effect on, you know, acquiring funding, of course, you know, growth, retaining customers. So yeah, follow those five things, I think, when it comes to a logo. So simplicity, minimal, iconic, relevant, and make it timeless.
Another question, what do you do when it's not obvious what visuals to use? Because there are none. It's very, maybe an abstract technology or a medical company something like this. All the time, right? What do you do as an agency? You have to come up with some visuals.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of ways around this, of course. Whether you focus on the word mark itself, whether you try to dig in for something a little bit more abstract, right? And, you know, and if all of, sometimes, you know, the technology company will actually have, you know, not even a word mark, will have not even an icon. They'll have like a mascot or something that actually means, you know, or kind of like.
Sorry for interrupting. I don't mean the logo. Yeah, not the logo, but the entire like website and the branding materials and everything. So like those.
What to do in that sense.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Well, okay. Well, see, of course you're talking to me. That's the most important part of the website, right? of the brand. No, in all fairness, you know, all good branding projects have to start off with, of course, what the intent is. So again, it shouldn't be focused on the technology. And this is where we stress always, time and time again, should never be focused on the technology, but what the technology can provide, what it does for the end user. So that's where the message has to hone in on. There's nothing wrong with starting a website with a very simple brand if you have to, right? I mean, there's nothing wrong with, you know, creating something that is more eye-catching or following a trend because, you know, websites are supposed to iterate. They're supposed to change. They're supposed to evolve. So while I am against a brand or a logo following trends, websites, social media, these absolutely should follow trends. So in this case, this is where, you know, you go to the competition and you see what trends are they following? Because again, you want to elevate your brand to try to at least keep pace with what they're doing. You don't have to focus so much if you don't have a logo yet. It will come when the time comes. You can just have your name in there with just a nice font. And often what happens is companies run with that for years. I don't think we've ever had a logo at ZFactor. It's always been a word mark. Heck, in fact, when we started our company, we didn't even have a company name. We started working for about 6 weeks before we finally figured out what we're going to name the company. So what I would do, though, is make sure that you understand what the value is that your technology would provide first and make sure that that's the message on the website. Because let's face it, when somebody comes to a website and greeted for a company that they know nothing about, well, focusing on the brand at that point has nothing. It doesn't matter because they're not going to know the brand. What they're going to want to know is what value is the product the brand is going to provide for me, right? So that's where it's more so, it's easy to follow a trend, but make sure that message is predominant, what you're going to provide for them. And then the brand will come from there. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Another question, getting closer to your brand. You have a lowercase z in front of your company name.
I do.
How is that in practice? I find this extremely hard to use. We have a couple customers at Usilus who have, lowercase spelling. I'm always troubled to make sure we use it right.
So it is lowercase and there's no space. It's all one word, right?
Yes,
ZFactor, yes. ZFactor. And yeah, this is a pain in the butt and it always is a pain in the butt. I'm not going to lie. You know, the reality is that has always been something that's been personal for me. I've always loved what I've done, but I've always been very humble. And, you know, unfortunately, and truth be told, Zedfactor doesn't have to do with my last name. It really, 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 really doesn't, I promise. But it stands for zeal factor, and zeal being fire, energy, enthusiasm. You know, when I started the company, that was the attitude we took, and we still do it today, which is why our color's red. But I didn't want anybody to ever associate it and say, oh, it's egocentric, dude. He just wants that. You know, that's why it's an uppercase. So I intentionally have always left it as lowercase. And does it cause an issue? It causes issues, but it also, those issues are talking points. And it always allows me to tell that story. It always allows me to explain, you know, Zedfactor, what it means, because people will always assume it's the one, but, you know, to our benefit, it's always a talking point to explain the other. And then they smile, they snicker, because that really is what our whole ethos is. It's all about the fire, the energy, enthusiasm in the experience that customers have working with us.
Let's talk about our main subject. Thanks for answering my practical questions, especially the logo detour. How has your agency brand, image, logo, your understanding of yourself evolved over those 23 years that you've been doing business?
Oh, God. So this has been a heck of a story. So again, like I said, I was fortunate. I was blessed. I was I knew what I wanted to do from a crazy, I think I was 12 years old when I watched this episode of Who's the Boss? You know, this great, you know, American show. And the woman in that show, she was an agency executive. And I remember watching her do these pitches of these creative ideas. And I was like, wow, I want to do that. And this was at about the age of 12. And then when I was in high school, I did have a knack for creativity, and I had an amazing teacher who introduced me to graphic design. And she's like, look, if you want to get into the world of advertising, you can do it through graphic design. And so from there, that's it. My whole world was everything graphic design. Actually, I was 14 when that happened. And so from 14 on, you know, I was on this line that I was going to have my own agency in 10 years, right? That was it. I was going to have an agency. Sure enough, you know, a day before my 24th birthday, we started Zedfactor. You know, it was fun. It was fumbly. We didn't even have a name, like I said. But, you know, it was just all in, you know, we're going to do this, right? And I was lucky. I moved from, you know, Toronto back to Waterloo because my parents said, look, you want to start an agency, come live back at home, you know, in our basement for no cost. So it was a perfect opportunity, right? And at the time, there was 34 other advertising agencies in this town, right? And this was a town back then of only about 250,000 people, right? Back then. And I needed to find a niche. And so I looked through it. So my father, you know, he was a worker. He worked with his hands. You know, he worked at a factory, you know, cement lining tanks, you know, everything in my life was trades. So what I realized is although there was like 34 other agencies in town, nobody focused in on the trade sector. And that was a huge market. There was these trade magazines out there, really boring, right? Trade magazines. Who wants to learn about injection molding or about metalworking? Well, apparently a lot of people do because there was, you know, like tons of these magazines out there and nobody was servicing that market. So right out of the gate, you know, we found a niche, which was going to be, we were going to be a B2B advertising agency, business-to-business advertising agency, focusing on manufacturers in the industrial industry. So we took the work that nobody else wanted. Right. We did, you know, we would flip through the magazines. We would look at an ad and be like, wow, that ad's horrible. They're spending $1,000 for this ad. And it looks like they did it themselves in their basement. We can help them. So we would pick up the phone. And back then, you know, the internet was just starting to come out, you know, 98. So we're picking up the phone and we're calling these people and we're saying, look, we can help you out for a couple $100. We'll build your ad. So this, you know, started growing our reputation. So within, you know, 3 years, we were an agency of, geez, I think back then we actually jumped up to 10 people, right? And in a really short amount of time. And, you know, for going from nothing to 10 was almost too much, to be honest. Because again, but it was just so fun because it was a total startup, right? We had some really, you know, shabby little space on top of an oil shop. You know, we had, you know, a Gettoni table up there. People would hang out. They would just come stop by. It was a party. It was a good time because it never felt like work, you know? And it was great because it just started this whole process of just like we had to find a niche. And so I've always been a big proponent of finding a niche and sticking with that niche. So at about the 10-year mark, right, we embraced digital technology. We realized that, you know, the internet was this thing, it was coming, not even 10 years, actually, it was probably more about the 7-8 year mark. And we knew we had to figure out a way on how to make the internet work for us. So what we did is we took what we learned offline, right? Which is, you know, how to market, messaging, you know, how to help these companies position themselves, how to brand these companies. And then we took it online because back then people still weren't sure, you know, what a web page was and how to use it. So really, although they were more so brochure websites, we had this giant list of customers, big companies, and, you know, they all now needed websites. So we started evolving and evolving and evolving into, you know, embracing, sorry, web technologies. So what was interesting is, you know, we were purposely, you know, reinventing ourselves and constantly growing, right? Because an agency, it's a living organism. It has to keep evolving, right? We have to keep evolving with trends. We have to keep evolving with technology. And for the other agencies that didn't evolve, they just started dying. So while they were dying, we kept on growing and growing and growing. So, you know, so we started offering more web technologies and we started understanding the web and understanding how to market web and understanding what actually viral meant at a really early age and how to take that and put it into, you know, digital form. So not without saying that it all went perfect, because it totally didn't, because we, you know, we did well, we understood well, we hit a couple of recessions, you know, and unfortunately, when a recession hits, industrial companies, they cut their marketing budgets, plain and simple. B2B companies, but especially that era, they would just, you know, close down. And sadly, even though this town back then was a business-to-business manufacturing town, right, which was a good thing, at the same time, it was a bad thing because recession hit, a lot of the manufacturing companies would actually shut down. So as they were shutting down, companies like BlackBerry were emerging, right? So, you know, we're in Waterloo here, and this is the home of BlackBerry. So, you know, it slowly started taking off. So what happened is then we started taking our technologies over to BlackBerry, and we started trying to solve their internal problems. And then what we did is we took what we learned, these manufacturing companies, and started creating internal websites for BlackBerry, because they had all these teams and they had thousands of employees and they literally had to market to each other internally. So for years, we started just growing within another big company, to the point where BlackBerry was probably about two thirds the size of our company. And it was a great experience, but it also, you know, it caused a lot of problems, because there was a certain look, a certain feel you had to be in, and we weren't genuine to what we were, right? So although, you know, we would get stuff done and people knew we were responsible for getting done, this is the company that got things done, they would tell us how we had to act. They would tell us how we had to look. Oh, we're kind of expected to dress up when you come in here and you have to do this and you have to. So it really took a toll on the creativity. Needless to say, BlackBerry went through some issues. And in 1 year, they literally cut all their contracts with vendors. And we went from, you know, being 75% BlackBerry to now 25% everybody else. And we lost that contract. Unfortunately, it came at a really bad time, because we had moved to a new location, larger location. We took on a mortgage. We actually grew for the right reasons. And then all of a sudden we had to scale down from, you know, back then, I think we were almost like 14 people. And then we had to bring it all the way back down to like 3. And it was really, that was devastating. That was horrible, right? But, you know, it kind of gave us a good chance to reflect, kind of see how everything was. And I realized what I lost during that, it was probably the best thing that could have happened, because, you know, it was a good time to reflect. We never shut down by any means. We were nowhere near. I was never going to let that happen. But it allowed me to reflect on, you know, what was I doing that I wasn't enjoying? And the reality is I wasn't being authentic to our brand. I wasn't being authentic to us. You know, we were always a creative company. We were always, you know, people pleasers, of course, right? But in this case, we were sucked into a corporate world. And then we had to try to be what they wanted us to be, which was detrimental to the brand. And this is why now it's like, you know, completely opposite to what we were. So what I did is I completely blew up our brand. I created this totally off the wall, ridiculous, you know, outrageous brand that involved a garage and flames and fire and this and that. It was so ridiculous, but it was so creative that people would pick up the phone and they'd say, you know what? Like, you're crazy. We love that. We need somebody that's just willing to go somewhere out there. And I think that's when the brand started coming all around, right? So it became, it had to be authentic to who we were. And this is where the idea of the skateboards came back into play. The idea that we're not going to be this corporate. We're not this corporate person. We're not this corporate company. We don't, you know, follow rules what you're supposed to. And so we stayed authentic and true to ourselves. Like, you know, to the point where it's like, you know, customers would stick with us because they enjoyed working with us. Of course, the brand, but the brand, the work, that came second, right? Like even in our pitch decks, when we would give testimonials on, you know, what people say about us, right? We don't do the, you know, after working with Zedfactor for so many years, blah, 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 blah. No. We put the remarks that, you know, reflect who we are. Like, you know, one customer said, boom, nailed it. That's a testimonial, right? Or another customer for a large telecom said, that is like 1 trillion times better than what we had. Again, you know, that's the kind of stuff that resonates with people. This might not be for everybody, right? And that's fine, but this is what it is for us. And this is the experience that we realized it was for working with us. So this is where we ended up embracing this, you know, louder than life, in your face brand. You know, we still embrace our niche, but we grew our brand to be more authentic. And again, we're not for everybody, but that's not a bad thing. And I think that's key. And that's where it was hard to come to that point that, you know, you don't have to be, you know, everything to everybody. It's a giant world out there. Your customers, I mean, there are billions of people, you know, that are looking for our help. We just have to service a very small amount. And those are the people that love working for us. They love working with us. You know, they get that, you know, we're a little bit more off the cuff. We're a little bit more casual, you know, but at the same time, we're always delivering. And that's the one underlying brand truth that always came in is we have good work and we're always delivering. We're making sure that, you know, we've always been obsessed over our client relationship. So that's where the brand started evolving, that we were a little bit loud, a little bit eccentric, a little bit outrageous. I mean, we have our company tenants on skateboards in here as art, right? Because again, it kind of goes back to that rebellion against the norm. And I think that was lost, that was found again. And now that is what's continued taking us on from years ago till, you know, what's going to be the future for the next 25 years. So, sorry, that was a lot, eh?
I'm so glad to hear that your company started blooming when you started to have fun with what you do in the process and with your brand and everything. That's so great.
And it takes, you can't be scared takes
ages.
For that.
It takes ages to accept that you are yourself. You only have one life to live, and you've got to enjoy the process because it's just never ending work. Like if you make it fun, Absolutely. Then it remains fun, right?
You know, it was enlightening because I remember once, you know, once, only once, there was a small screw up on a customer's job, right? It doesn't happen often, but when it did, I felt horrible. And this was probably about 8 years ago, I remember. And it was just, this solidified our decision, right? Because what happened is then I actually picked up the phone. I called the client. I said, listen, I'm sorry. I don't want you to think that we're not professional and that we don't take work serious. We're really good. It was a small oversight and I'll completely take care of it. And then we hung up that conversation and he called back 5 minutes later. And I thought, oh God, this is it. He's calling to tell me that, you know, they're cutting the deal, we're done. And he said, you know what? I appreciate you calling me. And I know you're professional and I know your work is on target, right? But I don't stay with you because of that. I stay with you because I enjoy working with you guys. I enjoy working, you know, that you guys are zany and fun and crazy and you kind of enlighten our day. And that was the biggest sign that we're onto something here. And it's crazy because, I mean, we have customers and, you know, although we're always professional, we're always, you know, making sure our quality is 100% and we're meeting every deadline, but we don't pull back. We crack jokes with customers. You know, we are, you know, sometimes we're not rude by any means, but we make sure that we enjoy this experience and the customer enjoys the experience. And they know, they feel that zeal that this company is about. And again, might not be the most professional way of doing things, but I don't want to be professional. I don't want to have to harp on anything professional.
Reminds me, I want to link our listeners to the episode with Meg Luce about finding your personal design style. And her personal design style is crazy creative and bright and fun and everything. And she talks about how to actually nail that and try to analyze yourself, figure out what features you want to make part of your style and things like that. So if you want to give that a listen, we're going to link to that in the show notes.
I mean, and she's absolutely right. You have to be authentic to yourself. Sometimes, I mean, again, everybody can do things however they want. That's fine. What works for me won't work for everybody else. But I often read how agencies talk about themselves. And, you know, I have to chuckle because a lot of times they're not being authentic. They're trying to market themselves. They're trying to market themselves into saying stuff that they believe people want to hear. But the reality is, after dealing with that company and realizing they're a bunch of twits, or realizing, you know, that they're egomaniacs and they're not fun to work with, I mean, you can see through all the fluff like really, really quickly. And that's one thing. That's why our website is so minimal. I hate our website. It's so damn boring. But I mean, again, it's authentic. It is us. It's the way we do things. We greet everybody with a different message every day. You know, we're simple. We're playing to the point. And, you know, again, talk to us and then you'll love us. And that's kind of our whole idea.
Do you measure or willing to share with us the breakdown of clients that come to you by referral, by repeat purchase, so to speak, from finding you actually? Like, what is the breakdown?
So cold calls, you know, will be the smallest one. That's probably about, we'll say less than 20% of the customers we get on an annual basis are just random phone calls. Obviously, we try to keep clients for as long as ever, right? Like I said, one of our customers has actually been with us for, you know, since we started, literally within the first 3 weeks of starting Zedfactor, they're still with us. I embrace this customer for life mentality. And this kind of goes to this whole ethos. I make sure that the experience that customers have with us are so good and that we're here to make them look like rock stars, that when they leave their company and go to another company, they bring us along. They call us, right? And this has actually been how we've received the best work. The biggest clients has always been when customers leave from one company to another. I mean, BlackBerry, although it was detrimental to this company for a little while, what happened is everybody realized when we worked there how great, number one, our work was, but then number two, that we actually got shit done. Right. And they knew that this wasn't this whole agency loop of, you know, well, we want to think about this and bullshit all the way around. We were like, no, let's get something out and let's iterate instead. They remembered that. And so instantly, you know, after that company fell apart and people started leaving, we started getting phone calls within a year after saying, hey, you know, do you remember me? We worked together at BlackBerry. Guess where I am now? I'm at this company. And all of a sudden, just all these new opportunities came because we embrace this customer for life attitude. We treat every customer like gold. We make sure that they feel like they're more friends, they're more chums, right? As opposed to what we don't want to be referred to as a vendor. We want to be referred to as a partner. And we don't want our customers to think of us as a vendor. We want them to think of us as friends. The relationship goes further than the work does. And in this case, this has been the single. So referral, not so much. We do get a ton of referrals. Some of our great clients are referral clients, but even more so, it's the customer for life mentality that has brought us more work above anything else.
Over the last year or so, you've literally turned yourself into a media company to a certain angle. You've started producing a podcast. You started also producing videos for your YouTube channel. That's a lot of effort. What stands behind? What's the strategy?
Cool. So two different strategies. The YouTube channel. So going back prior to COVID, of course, we were at this point where it was like, okay, you know, manufacturing's gone, you know, and agencies are often generalists. They take anybody who's willing to pay them. They're scattered. And that just felt, that didn't sit right. So I had a great meeting with the team and I said, listen, guys, let's go for broke. You know, we love learning how things work. We understand technology, but we have all these other companies that aren't technology companies. Let's trim everything down and focus in on technology. That's it. We just want to focus. We love how things are made. We know how things are made. Let's focus in on just becoming a B2B technology company, right? Because the engineers that we dealt with in the manufacturing companies were the exact same people, the exact same engineers, mentality, thought process that we're now in the technology companies. So it was a perfect transition for us. So, you know, within that first year, we had to, you know, we let go of some customers, unfortunately, but then we picked up a lot of new customers. And so within the first year, it was like, okay, that was a good move, but now how do we help, right? How do we put this out? How do we put more information out? Because at the same time, you know, offering information, you know, it's a slow process. So this is where Design for Tech came from. You know, we created the YouTube channel Design for Tech, you know, and it's not so much to acquire customers, but to share information on what technology companies should be doing when it comes to their brand, when it comes to their products, how to actually market, how to position themselves. We were trying to give away information for free, you know, with the intent of course, to help technology companies, you know, evolve than what they are. Because again, we firmly believe that, you know, if a design, if, if a technology company was to embrace design earlier on in the process, make sure it's at the table with their technology, it would actually help their brand in the long term, right? It helps give them clarity. And by design, I don't mean make things look good, right? It's not about how it looks. It's about, you know, who it's for. It's about, you know, the long-term goal, right? It's actually to create a plan long-term and stick to that. Like as we spoke earlier, you know, early stage technology companies are infamous for changing their brand based on opportunities, right? And they'll change their brand in one direction, another direction based on the opportunities. So we wanted to make sure we bring that to light and start creating, you know, a set of videos to actually start, you know, helping them give advice, helping them, you know, understand that, you know, that they're faltering when they're jumping for opportunities and, you know, they need to have clear direction. So this is where the Design for Tech YouTube channel came from. And I mean, again, well received, you know, we've gotten referrals from that. We have gotten some business from that. But at the same time, it was more of a credibility play. Right? People appreciate that. It's almost like, you know, there's this wall and they don't want to pick up the phone and reach out and talk to somebody because they're going to feel like there's a hard sale coming from this point. The YouTube channel was an amazing opportunity to kind of put out information for free so people could take a look at us, kind of see what, you know, the founder was like, see how eccentric this person was, me, and then see the information. So at the very least, there was credibility when they were ready to pick up the phone and call. So that's where Design for Tech came from, which has worked out really well for us. The podcast, The Angry Designer, that was something a little different. So this is, and this is why I'm flattered because now I know how much work that goes into a podcast. So I am flattered to be here with you because you've done this so long. You're the pro at this. The podcast that we started, The Angry Designer, came out, you know, as kind of like a, you know, it was COVID, we were shut down. We needed to vent. We needed to get something out there. And, you know, at this point, you know, I've been in the industry for 22 years. I've got a ton of experience. And again, I'm not your average designer per se. You know, a lot of designers out there are, you know, a little bit more, you know, reserved. Maybe some of them are a little bit more egocentric. Maybe they take themselves a little too seriously. And that never sat well with me. And I knew that there was a bunch of people, outcasts, as we call it, that were similar, you know, to the way we were. So, and then after researching things a little bit more and looking into it, you know, you'd think that after 20 years, you know, designers would just be hitting their peak of creativity. You know, painters do this, architects do this. At 20 years, they're like, you know, this is just when they start mastering their skill. But the reality is, like in the 40s, there's less than 25% of the designers out there are in their 40s. And then in their 50s, it drops down to less than 5%. So there was this crazy decline of designers out there and they just kept on disappearing and it drove me nuts, you know? And then the more we looked into it, you know, was, you know, we realized that, you know, there was certain things like obviously they couldn't keep up with technology and they didn't have help, you know, they ageism was a problem and, you know, they disappeared for that. Some of them got burnt out, the pace of the industry. There were so many things that you could just see a drop off of designers and it literally broke my heart.
Could it be that they shifted to other things to do, like going up, not down the food chain?
Absolutely. And that is some of the recommendations we make, right? And I hoped that that was the case, right? Often. But then after digging deep in Reddit, you just see just the effect that this industry had on people. And a lot of them would drop off. So the smart ones would evolve, continue growing up the ladder. But at the same time, you know, there were so many instances of people just being fed up. And they had it. They bounced. There were so many issues in the industry. And, you know, and the scary one, of course, is ageism. Sadly, you know, we have a podcast that we talk about ageism. Yeah, it's called Where Are All the Older Designers? But I mean, the funny thing is we started seeing this trend of people. So we started the Angry Designer podcast to help fuel designers to reach, you know, 25, 30, 40 year careers. You know, we kind of wanted to cut through all the bull that, you know, we encounter all the time in the industry. And then we want to help other designers through those times and help them get through those times, whether it's moving up the corporate ladder, whether it's their next step, whether it's understanding certain technologies that they're just getting fed up with. So, I mean, we talk about everything from design, technology, trends in the industry, ageism, you know, conflicting personalities. Like it's an interesting space, right? And the fun thing, the great thing about this is really early on, we would get feedback from designers saying, you know, you're saying stuff that we've always felt. Thank you. You should be, you know, considering yourself a mental health type podcast, right? Because we have fun with this, right? Again, we drink bourbon while we're doing it. You know, we don't hold back. Ooh, I know, right? So bad. And, you know, we really have fun with this. We don't pull any punches back. We're not worried about offending people, you know, because we know that there's certain kind of designers out there that, again, we're not for everybody, right? Just like my agency isn't for everybody.
Tell us about your co-host for the show, because you're not interviewing guests. You're just enjoying yourself. Who is the other one?
How funny is that?
Who is the other angry designer?
The other angry designer is Sean Carlisle. He's my senior designer over here. And he is also somebody who's been in the space for 30 years. So again, interestingly enough, I've known Sean for about 20 years, but about 10 years ago, he was going through this, right? He was suffering what a lot of the designers would. You know, his career started just kind of diminishing a little bit. He was starting to lose motivation, lose steam because it was such a new pace. And I was like, you know what, dude? Like, come join me. Come join my agency. You know, he was someone I knew, somebody I trusted. Sadly, like, I mean, he at the time, he had lost his one job. He was struggling to find, you know, position again in another agency because, you know, he was in a niche space that, you know, was slowly being phased out. And, you know, he didn't position himself. He was at a grocery store for a little while because he was scared to reach out, right? And again, I think that's what happens. They kind of settle in the short term. And thank God I found that out really quick. He was in the grocery store for 3 weeks when I found out. And I was like, hell no. You're coming back here, right? And again, we've also grown together. You know, he's our senior designer. He's a design lead. If I wasn't the creative director, he would be, right? He manages the whole back, of course, and he's the person that, you know, I share everything with on this podcast. So, you know, and he's got just as much, you know, spit and anger as I do when it comes to this. So,
you know, your podcast title can only be beaten by Everyone Hates Marketers by Louis Vanier, like in terms of your brand being so negative.
The angry designer. The funny thing is, and the funny thing is, okay, sir, the angry designer does sound pretty bad, but it came out to the fact that, I mean, I'm Italian. So just by nature, I'm fiery. I talk. When people talk, they're like, wow, this guy's yelling. And I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm not angry. I'm just excited because I'm Italian. This is the way we talk. We're passionate. So this is where the whole angry designer came from, that we're, you know, we're not holding back. We're pretty intense about this. At the same time, you know, we make sure that it's an enjoyable experience. We laugh, we crack jokes. I'm sure not everybody finds them funny, but you know, the few people that have reached out have. So that has been an amazing. So that podcast has been great because it has kind of felt like, I mentioned earlier too that, you know, a lot of times you try to find something to give back to, right? And, you know, whether it's organizations, non-for-profits, this, that, you know, growing a business sometimes can feel a little selfish, right? Because you're like, I need to find a bigger purpose. This has kind of now become that bigger purpose because, I mean, the designers that we're talking to, you know, who feel like they're stuck, feel like they're in ruts, and not just graphic designers, you know, UX designers are already feeling it. You know, web designers are feeling it. You know, it's a struggle, this space, and it can take its toll on people. So we kind of, you know, basically we call bull on everything that we think is, you know, pretentious and ridiculous. We call bull on these crazy, you know, marketing plans that people are suggesting you have to do and all these hoops and loops and this and that. And we're just saying, you know what, you really don't have to go that far. You know, you need to enjoy what you do. You need to be real. I mean, last night's episode, we ranted about perfection and how it was unattainable, right? And how people need to understand that, you know, to stress and obsess over perfection is only doing them harm. And then the other thing we ranted about was humility and, you know, like how some people associate being humble with being, you know, insecure, you know, having imposter syndrome, which is total bullshit. Oh, sorry. Can I swear in this?
You've been saying that throughout. Don't worry.
Oh, no. But it's true, right? Imposter syndrome, being humble is nothing to do with imposter syndrome, right? Being humble is thinking less of yourself and you know, more of other people, right? How that? And so again, these are topics that we talk about, we cover, you know, and it's just cool that even if we help one person through a tough time, it would be worth it. But I think we're maybe helping more than one. So yeah, so...
As we're wrapping up today's episode, what would be one piece of advice that you could give to our listeners who are starting or running an agency? And one piece of that is being yourself and enjoying yourself. Absolutely. So in addition to that, what's your top recommendation?
So the top recommendation, and I know this is kind of a hot topic, but it has served us well our entire lives. You know, although I'm going to say be awesome to your customers and treat them great and treat them like gold and obsess over that experience, which is true. It's harder to build an agency around that. But I do feel that the single thing that has helped us get through besides perseverance, of course, is finding that niche. And again, people are scared that thinking that a niche is only going to limit them. But the reality is, just because you've niched down into a space doesn't mean you can't take on other work, right? We have become niche. We are B2B technology. We work with B2B technology companies. We help them be more human, look more global. This is what we're known for, right? It doesn't mean that this is people, they're coming to us for just this. People understand that we're good with what we do, you know, and we have the space. Can we help them in other ways, right? Being a niche has always helped us get through those tough times, and it makes us become an expert. And then all of a sudden, what that does is it kind of separates us from our competitors. And in my opinion, we don't have any competitors, right? There's other agencies, there's other companies that service customers in the same way and offer the same type of deliverables. But the reality is, you know, there's no other B2B technology focused agency in this space, in this area. And that's what's kind of helped us. So now those 34 agencies that I talked about when we started, there's only three left. And we're one of those three. So that feels really good, not going to lie. And I can genuinely say that besides the perseverance, the single thing that has helped with that is niching down into a space and becoming an expert in the space. I still touch everything. We still help people with print. We still, you know, help people with branding. We still help people with web. Our breadth of services are wide, but our area of focus is very niche. And I think that's key for any company.
That's very extremely useful advice. Thanks so much. Congratulations on your journey and perseverance, as you say. That's incredible.
Thank you. A
couple brief words. We've talked about your website, your shows. Where can people find those online?
So I would encourage people to visit us, visit our podcast at theangrydesigner.com. You can find us on there. We're also on Spotify. We're on Apple. We're on Google. You can find us almost anywhere, you know, so that's definitely for our podcast where I would encourage everybody to come and listen to us rant. We are on YouTube as Design for Tech. So we're just youtube.com/designfortech. And of course, the agency itself is zfactor.com. But, you know, don't worry about that one. Go visit our fun channels. I think you'll get more entertaining, more value from the other two.
Where can people find you personally, like on Twitter and other places?
Ah, good point. I am on Instagram. I'm a little private in that sense. I'm not going to lie. LinkedIn would be a bigger place for me. I'm a little bit more active on LinkedIn. But yeah, I guess I kind of pop in and out on Instagram. I am not the most social person, even though I realize I need to work on this. I am. I am social through the Angry Designer podcast. How about that?
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. This is a great story, and have a wonderful rest of your week.
Jane, thank you so much. It has been a total honor being on your show.